and are you running away from something or are you running towards something? We are getting close to all of this stuff colliding in a way that freaks me out a little bit. How do I get closer to finding the thing that I'm deeply compulsive about? It is impossible to evaluate an idea in pure idea space. You must act, you must do, you must create, you must build. My core motivator more than anything else is probably like freedom to continue to get to experience the richness of the world.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This week's guest is Jackson Dahl. Jackson is a venture capitalist and was on the founding team of esports company 100 Thieves. We talk about finding your compulsion, oscillating between interest areas, navigating accelerating technological change, the relationship between creators and audiences, building community online and in person, and art and creativity. Please enjoy. One of the things I've noticed about you is that you've had this ability to find and become a part of world-class teams. So lowercase, 100 Thieves, Paradigm. I think that's a rare quality. And I'm curious what you attribute that to, both in terms of finding and getting noticed by excellent or world-class people. Is there something you know about that process that others don't?
Yeah, a couple things come to mind. One is, in all three of those cases, it was definitely sort of like anchored by a curiosity or an interest in a specific person. So in the case of, or I guess a couple, in the case of lowercase, I was in college, didn't know a ton about venture capital, and like had heard about who Chris Sacca was, and really had like listened to one podcast or two from Matt Mazzio, who was Chris's partner at the time, who really was running the firm day to day, and I worked with, and like I was just like, holy cow, this guy is, I want to like have his job, or I want to learn from him. He had been at CAA, so forth. So I kind of sought Matt out. In the case of 100 Thieves, it wasn't quite so explicit that I had sought out Matt or Nadeshot. I also work for a lot of Matt, so I'll try to use clarifying names. But I was introduced to Nadeshot by my friend Blake Robbins, and it was a similar thing where I was like, oh, wow, this guy's really special. And then in the case of Paradigm, it was similar too, where I had a relationship with Fred Ursem, and we were just friends, but it was like, Fred is a really, really special person. And I'm curious about like more about the world and the team that he's built. So I think there was partly that. I think the other thing maybe didn't totally apply at lowercase because I learned it at lowercase, but something that Chris Sacca always talked about was you kind of want to find opportunities where the deck is stacked in your favor, or where you have a bunch of really, really unfair advantages. It should be almost like ridiculous how sort of unfair the opportunity is out and in front of you. And so I think that was the other thing that, at least for 100 Thieves and Paradigm, was very much a part of my kind of like evaluation, which is like, there's a bunch of people trying to do these things. In the case of esports and gaming, even back then, there were a bunch of teams. Most of them were pretty undifferentiated. And then with Paradigm, it was similar, where like obviously a lot of VC funds. But in both cases, in 100 Thieves, like we were starting anew, but we had this guy who had this crazy massive audience, and more than even massive, like deeply, deeply engaged audience. And there were some uncertainties, of course. It was a Call of Duty audience and more of a lifestyle one than League of Legends what moved into. But it was like all these other teams are starting from scratch and they have no city to different. Like, it was very clear that we had an edge. And then with Paradigm, it was similar, which is I started to get to know the team there. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I think Matt Huang, lots of Matts, as I said. Matt Huang, who runs Paradigm with Fred, refers to them as like X-Men. Like, there are so many people at Paradigm who are just kind of like unique, exceptional, like freaks in a really good way. And in many cases, like not necessarily well-rounded, but just like deeply, deeply spiky. So I think those are probably the two things that, at least from me looking for it, in terms of getting noticed, that's a harder thing to I could offer all of this advice that was probably like a weird mix of randomness and luck and right timing and something unique to me or the other person. I think in the case of maybe all of them, they emerged from somewhat from serendipity. It came from like my fostered relationships. So in the case of Mazzio, I ended up getting a warm introduction to him through someone who is a mentor and actually somebody I worked for, Carlos Adame at UMG, and really pursued Matt, but also had a guy who was willing to take a chance on me and go to Matt and say, hey, I really think you should meet with Jackson. And then I still had to impress Matt and kind of go above me on. Nadeshot was similar. And then with Paradigm as well, I had got to know Fred he had invested in 100 Thieves and he had just become a friend. So in many ways, like almost just pursuing deep relationships with people I really admired or I was curious about. It wasn't obvious that it would lead to the thing, but in all of those cases, it's sort of what set it off.
A quick sidebar on Lowercase that I think we talked about a few months ago when we first connected. I went back through my email, and in 2016, I was similarly enamored by Matt and Chris. And so I sent a cold email to Matt to see if I could like do anything to get on the team. And he CC'd you, and you ignored my emails for like 8 consecutive emails. So I'm still waiting for that response. Still a little
salty. I'm not always paying it forward. I've tried my best to do that sometimes, but clearly.
No, in your defense, I looked at my opening email and it was not great. I didn't have any kind of track record back then. One of the things that I've also seen kind of in your career is that you've done a bit of and you've only been a handful of companies, so I may be kind of turning this into a trend when it isn't yet. You've done a bit of oscillation between investing and operating. And I wonder, has that just been a function of the opportunities that have been presented themselves? Or is there something about that kind of movement back and forth between operating and investing that you enjoy?
I thought about this question a lot myself. I don't really have a firm answer. I think there is some pattern of oscillation in my career in general, which is to say, I don't know, when I was 15, I wanted to be Steven Spielberg or Steve Jobs, and I like couldn't decide between technology and media, and have spent most of my career oscillating even on that. Even at USC in college, like technically studied business, but was sort of oscillating between tech and computer science and film and cinema and media. And I think venture maybe is another version of that kind of oscillation where the closest to like an intentional thought I've had about it has been maybe in your career it's useful at times to be up on the surface kind of patrolling, and then there are other times where it's useful to go beneath it. You imagine like a submarine, like it's useful to go way, way, way down. Explore, exploit would be the other way of framing this. And I think at least early in your career, it's a really good way to kind of learn what pulls you, potentially find really good opportunities. So there's an idea I really like from a guy named Graham Duncan, where he talks about sort of at different points in your career, or maybe early in your career, you're refining reality, and at times you're then moving to asserting reality. And I think that it's not perfectly fair to say that venture and doing a startup are like the pure manifestations of those, but they can be. And I think especially for me early in my career at Lowercase, it was like this amazing 30,000 foot view of just like all of the things that potentially go into early stage startups and what opportunities are good, what founders are good, and all these things. Otherwise, though, I think I'm still trying to figure out like which of these two modes is more like kind of like purely manifesting what I really love. And I've oscillated between the two in part because I think I clearly really like parts of them. And at times it's hard to be down in the submarine for 3 or 4 years and you're like looking around, there's other things that are piquing your interest. And then you're up on the surface sometimes, you're like, wow, that it would be, I sort of miss being in the trenches. So an imperfect answer that I'm maybe ask me again another 5 or 10 years is, who knows, maybe I've oscillated continuously, but maybe I've had a little bit of clarity on.
Yeah. And maybe each situation is so unique that it's hard to create any kind of heuristic or guideline that can be used in each of those future situations. I'm not sure. At least with super high fidelity. To dig in a little bit deeper on that topic, at least in the handful of experiences you have had switching careers, how do you know when to wrap up kind of a period or segment of your life versus dig in your feet and maybe take the submarine a little bit deeper? Is it just like a kind of feeling, or is there something a little bit more logical or practical about it?
That's a good question. A couple things come to mind. One bit of advice I was given was to question, are you running away from something or are you running towards something?
And I think that can apply in
a lot of it can apply in a lot of contexts in life, not just work. And it's something that is hard to parse out sometimes on the surface, or you can convince yourself that you're running towards when you're really running away. So that's one thing I think about. I think a lot about inertia, which is to say most of us sort of find ourselves in a path and continue along that path indefinitely, not necessarily because of intention, but because of it's sort of like, if there's one third thing that life or the universe is good at, it's like flattening you out and continuing. Like, inertia is the strongest force in the universe. So I maybe am particularly predisposed to be thinking about that and like not wanting to just continue because it is the set path. Another, I think something you and I have talked about, a friend, Nathan Bashes, many, many years ago, maybe like 8 or 9 years ago, told me, he's like, I try to look back at myself 6 months ago continuously, or at least fairly regularly. And if I don't feel that I was really naive, at least in some dimension, 6 months prior, I'm probably not growing. And so that's a useful frame too. And all of this within some amount of bounds. I think another bit of advice I was given by someone quite wise is, he's like, Jackson, do you think when you're 45, you'll be hung up on whether you spent 3 years or 5 years in this opportunity? And the answer is like, obviously no. And so I think that goes both ways. It can be, hey, if something's not right, change it. Like, what are you waiting for? But it can also be like, don't get hung up on like, I wasted 6 months or I wasted 12 months. Like, these things are, it's much more about kind of making the right decisions on, I think, like a 3 or 5 or 10 year time horizon than like wigging yourself out on like too much optimization. The shortest answer to your question that I've taken a long time to get to, though, is that I think at the end of the day, you can take in a ton of great inputs and talk to a ton of people and try to be really systematic about it. And then at the end of the day, you're still going to make a decision based on your gut, I think. Which right. is to say, like, it's sort of like the advice, like, make plans and then feel free to disregard them. Like, you're ultimately kind of collecting that info so you can make a decision that is hopefully running towards something rather than just running away.
Over the last several months, you've stepped into a bit of a smaller role with Paradigm to create some space to explore. Not to say that you're stepping away entirely, but I think on this theme of finding what's next and going through kind of the cycle, what are the criteria or considerations that you've been thinking about for what is next? And maybe tactically, as a part of that, what is the process for discovering those?
Yeah. So I moved into a smaller role, basically working with a few portfolio companies, but mostly out and taking a break. And I think that came ultimately from like, how do I get closer to finding the thing that like is I'm deeply compulsive about. And it goes a little bit back to the sort of invest versus build question. There's some of that for sure that I think is top of mind. I think also it was just, I didn't even realize like how nice it would be to take like an extended break. And it's definitely nice to just like let the curiosity run wild. I think I've talked to a bunch of people about the right ways to approach time like this. Or pursuing the next opportunity, I think the resounding answer would be that there's infinite advice out there. Some of it is right for you, and most of it can be disregarded, and it's hard to know. So I think there's definitely
all advice cancels out.
Yeah. All advice definitely cancels out. I've literally gotten completely opposite advice from two people, like back-to-back days, who I deeply respect, for whom it was like the right thing for them, and like I don't know.
Right.
I think what I've tried to do is, do a mix of spend time with people I really admire, try to let the curiosity run wild. I think lately, one clear thought has been that you can only spend so much time like sitting in a room thinking about what you might like to do. And at some point, you must act. It is impossible to evaluate an idea in pure idea space. It must, like, the rubber must hit the road. And then I think maybe the last thing I've been thinking about a little bit recently is like trying to get better at like purely seeing where I am drawn and what I might enjoy rather than like shoulds and should nots, especially when those maybe have compounded over periods of time. Another version of this would just be like, I don't know, the two paths for me aren't inherently go start a tech startup or be a venture capitalist, even though those two might be the most likely. And trying to like see what is object and what is subject there. Well, like what are the things that I sort of have preconceived? Mm. But I'm clearly still on this path. I think maybe the one thing I would say, just to reiterate it, that I'm especially prone to falling into is you must act, you must do, you must create, you must build, you must whatever, to evaluate something fully. It's not going to like hit you. You're not going to be like sitting and the wave's not going to hit you and like will you into action. I think in almost all cases, although maybe some people are different.
I had a similar realization recently. I think I tweeted out like the answer isn't in your head. It's out in reality. And the only way you get that answer is by interacting with reality and getting feedback. So it's important to have these periods of life where you do the deep introspective work, but that has to, if that doesn't, come about as a new way in which you interact with the outside world, then it's, I think it's all been for naught.
Yes.
You on the note of compulsion, I don't want to ask so directly what it is you feel like what answer you've come to about what you are compelled to do, that thing that I think David Senra says, that thing that somebody can't pay you $1 billion to not do.
Yeah. It's an amazing version of that question. That was told to me actually by Jeremy Jiffen, who I think has been on this podcast from David.
Yeah.
But like people love the, what would you do if you had $1 billion? And man, that inversion is so much better because it really, hopefully you're already doing some approximation of it. Anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
No, I was going to ask, I mean, I'll tie in a quote that really resonated with me from one of your pieces. You said that if you aren't legible to the world, if people don't get you, it's on you. And so you posed this question to yourself, which was, what is the core meme I want people to think of when they think of Jackson? And so interrelated with this question of like, what is your compulsion is what you want people to kind of see you for, perceive you as. So what is, and you can take either of those kind of angles to the question, what's that? The best answer you've come up with, and maybe what's the version history behind that? What does that evolution look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think answering that question maybe is like the prominent thing that I've been trying to dig into in the last few months. And in general, I think this idea space is one that I'm like very, very obsessed with. There's another articulation of this that comes from Kevin Kelly, where he's just talking about sort of like the goal of life being to become most fully yourself, and he specifically talks about like how you have to make it easier on people to sort of like get you. I think whereas maybe previous versions of me in the past would be like frustrated if I was pigeonholed in some box based on what I've done, especially because I've kind of zagged a lot of times. When I was leaving lowercase to go to do esports, there was a lot of like, what are you doing? And when I was leaving esports to do crypto, there's a lot of, what are you doing? And so I think I'm always like a little bit, maybe even from an ego standpoint, like a little wary of being pinned down.
Right.
So the answering this question is trying to like fight through that. To answer it, I think like what I love to do is to meet and learn from and talk to special people or high potential people about what lights them up and about the things that are in their head, and like get better at like helping them rotate the objects perspective, probably more than anything else. I think there are a few other things, which is to say, I've always been obsessed with how the internet enables creative people. I think I've always been obsessed with this sort of intersection of technology and media and sociology and the ways that like the internet is changing the fabric of how we work. And so as I try to think about like what the right meme is, there's probably, and you might hear all that and say, oh, wow, it sounds like probably pretty obviously like a consumer internet venture capitalist or something. And that's certainly a thought I've had. But yeah, that's the essence that, or at least the fabric that I've been trying to like parse out, like what is pure. The short answer is I don't really have that meme yet. I think that the thing that I've been thinking about a little bit, there's this awesome image that Jacob Horn from Zora created. And he actually showed it to me in person before he posted it to Minted or whatever. But it's basically this like concentric circles, and all of the circles around the center are like idea, 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 idea. And then in the middle is meme. And it's sort of like the visual articulation of this question. So you can imagine, for example, Jacob has an example for his company Zora, but one of the examples he gave that I really loved is you put like an American flag in the middle, and you have all of these ideas of what it means to be American, which, by the way, are probably going to change pretty dramatically for different people, whether it's liberty or diversity or kind of like meritocracy, like all democracy, all these things. And the most American thing is not actually any of those ideas around. It's like the meme. It's the American flag. And so I have been thinking about that. I think I'm probably in the process of trying to parse out what that is. And maybe to the point of the earlier question, it's sometimes hard to articulate that meme until it's like appeared. And I think the way it appears sometimes is not by like considering it or like everything I just said in the beginning of that question, like ask ChatGPT to like summarize. I think it's probably more likely that emerges through some act or creation or something like that. So that's a work in progress answer for you. Maybe for the soundbite, I guess I'm like, I really, really just love to find out what makes people like move and tick and like what is the thing that like gets you. I love to ask people what they're motivated by, because they usually give you some BS answer like money or something, and then you get to ask three or four more times and you start to get to something deeper.
That the very first articulation and the last one, the soundbite, is eerily similar to the one that I've come up with for myself, that's like featured prominently at the top of my to-do list, so I see it every day, and it's something to the effect of I get energized by hearing what other people are energized about. And to take that to the next step, which I haven't done yet very much in my career, which ties in with venture, or at least venture as a way of doing this, is helping support those people. Like how can you amplify them? How can you help them through investments? How can you help connect them to other networks, to mentors, whatever it might be? And I hope the reason I started this podcast is in part because it's an instantiation of kind of that articulation. But I think there's still some missing elements that I'm still figuring out. And like you said, I think it's a living statement that's always evolving too. It's not fixed. Through the course of this conversation, and while I was doing kind of some research and reading on you, it seems like there are kind of these pulls in your life that you feel torn between or pulled between. Two examples of which are, you mentioned during while you were in college at USC, is like the kind of media or cultural side, and then tech. We talked about going into venture versus operating. Do you feel a need to try to reconcile or integrate these things, or do you think there's another way to solve it, which is there's a couple other ways to solve it? One is continuing with the oscillation. It's like there's just periods of life where you do each, or you give way to one and you say, at least for the foreseeable future, 10 years, 20 years, this is the thing I do. But I guess first, do you feel like that internal tension struggle frequently? And second is, how do you attempt to wrestle with it or resolve it?
Yeah, so I certainly feel it. It's a great question. I feel it. I think also I am someone who is predisposed to want to preserve optionality. I think like my core motivator more than anything else is probably like freedom to continue to get to experience the richness of the world. And so choosing a path inherently is one that like, well, I've gotten lots of great wisdom from all kinds of, from very kind of like esoteric guru types to like very practical types, kind of giving me the feedback, like just commit to something. Like it goes back to the earlier discussion. On the other hand, I am a little averse to like the give way to one frame. Cause I think my suspicion is that for most of us who find ourselves in between worlds or oscillating, and this can take so many different forms, there is probably something very kind of like pure essence wise that is like calling between those two things. And so going back to the Kevin Kelly thing, or the thing we've talked about in a bunch of different contexts of like, how do you become most yourself? The chances that choosing just technology, for example, creating software or something like that, or just media or culture or something more oriented kind of the likes of taste, like the chance that like succumbing to one of those and not like, and cutting off this other part of myself is the direction to really most purely like manifesting my essence, like that seems unlikely. And so part of this is maybe you even framed it as like sort of how do you like, or maybe I heard this, but like, do you thread the needle between the two? Or maybe the answer is you actually like go around. There's some alternative, you go above or underneath. But that's the thing I'm probably holding on to. And I think most of us, or at least the people I really admire, in some sense, it's obviously their impact or what they've made, but also it's that they have sort of found a unique way to weave things together. So I'm holding on to it, at least for now. I think in terms of the different modes and the explore-exploit stuff, I think that's maybe a different thing and maybe depends more on the stage of life or career or whatever you're optimizing for. But I think when it comes to sort of like the things you're really drawn to, especially when it comes to domain or whatever, being able to combine non-obvious, not to say tech and media or whatever is the most unique thing in the world, but like be able to combine things, I think is probably room for some kind of edge.
Agreed. Yeah. And I, again, to not to continue to flip this back on myself, but I've seen the podcast as an opportunity to preserve the breadth by bringing on whoever it is I want to talk to, but also develop depth in terms of research and interviewing. And there's a handful of other skills. So I think that's something you can do across a number of domains. Maybe that's why investing has been interesting to you, because you do still get exposure to culture, media, tech. So I think there is a way for you to kind of have your cake and eat it too. if you had it your way, or to frame it a different way, 10 to 20 years from now, what do you foresee yourself being closest to number one in the world at in terms of your combination of skills? I like Scott Adams' framing of like a skill stack here, of like, you know, you could be top 10% in three different things, but if those are three unique things, the combination of which it means you're, you know, 0.001% in the world. What do you want those attributes or skills to be?
I think there is something around understanding how, as the inevitable train that is technical innovation kind of marches on, the fabric of society and of the things that make us very human, obviously this is interesting in the context of AI, is going to be altered. And it's sometimes easy to see that as a purely one-directional thing, but I think it's probably more reflexive than we give it credit, at least in the short to medium term. In the very, very long term, perhaps technology just wins. But I think that many of the things that we hope or we are pushing towards in a technical frame are going to be increasingly bounded by things that are not just can we invent the future. So I think understanding that interplay, along with being someone who can push people to reach deep within themselves and then also help them, again, rotate like the perspective in their head of like, I am running at this problem and I have been for a long time. Like, how can I rotate that object and come at it from a different perspective? Those are all very, very vague things that would be hard to articulate explicitly as skills, especially if I were a consultant or something. But I think that is probably the space I would most want to play. And that could take a bunch of different frames. But I think that is like an area where it will be easy to, perhaps the world is going to like fracture even more across that first point that I said. And I think there's probably room for people who can help kind of like surf that chasm in a way, and that's something I hope to do, or help people do.
You said that you thought this could be reflexive or temporary. What if it's not a technological issue, what are the other issues you're thinking about? Is it coordination? Is it cultural?
Yeah. I think we're moving towards a world of, there's been lots of conversation about like every generation thinks they're special and like the sky is falling. Things are finally different. And while it's possible, that we aren't special. I think the articulation I like the most for this, it comes from Tim Urban in Wait But Why, where he talks about sort of this 1,000-page book of human civilization, and we're on page 999 for the last 250 years. And if you looked at the first 900 pages, they were hunted and gathered, and in the first 990, and then on pages 990 to 999, it was sort of like maybe once a page there was like somebody like Genghis Khan shows up and there's something kind of happens. And then on page 999 is everything from 1750 or whatever to now. And so if you're an alien reading this book, you're like, this is really boring. And then on page 999, like they invent magic and everything starts going completely insane. So what's page 1,000 going to be like? It seems very clear to me that we are entering a world of like change is the only constant, and it's going to be way more, like way higher magnitude than ever before. I think people are deeply unprepared for it in general. I think we probably spend time in this like little corner of the universe that is very keyed into it. And even then, I think many of the people we know are freaking out about it. And obviously this is probably particularly acute with respect to artificial intelligence, but I think it applies across so many things. I think we're still in the early, we're 9-10 years, a little more, 14 years into the world of kind of like infinite speed, zero friction, coordination tool around value that is digitally native. And like, what are people going to do with that? And it's easy to criticize, but like, it's like a truly net new thing that we're so early in. Not to mention, you talk about things like the ways that biology is going to evolve and longevity, I think people, again, if you look at it 100-year time horizon or something to that order, maybe none of this social cultural stuff matters, but human beings are deeply, deeply tribal. Stories are what motivate and move us. I think in many cases, we're going to see severe resistance to much of the technological change that is coming. You even look at kind of very simple things like stem cells and self-driving cars and things like that, or automation in the last few decades. Like, it's going to get way, way crazier. I think we also probably live in a country that has a meaning crisis already, and people don't know what to believe in. And so it's easy to look at, oh, just like, max capitalistic, max kind of like techno futurist view that we're just going to solve all our problems. And I think it's probable or possible that we will. And then we're going to be at the top of the hierarchy of needs. And like, people are still sort of like empty. And that is maybe getting at where I'm most interested. There's also plenty of more practical things, which is just to say, is self-driving cars more limited today by technology or by social problems and coordination problems and regulation, all these types of things? I think maybe upstream of almost everything that isn't, can we invent the future though, is like, how do people feel about it on some level? Or what are the core memes we as a society can address, whether that's coming from politicians or from other types of kind of like talk, like it feels that we are getting close to all of this stuff colliding in a way that freaks me out a little bit. I'm certainly an optimist, I think, general about technology, but like, man, we are speeding ahead into something that is probably at least something approaching like a populist versus sort of like elite techno-futurist battle line rather than the left and right battle line. So anyway, all of this stuff is relevant maybe to trying to answer that question.
You recently tweeted on that note that you think learning, and I quote, learning and teaching how to deal with constant dramatic change will be the most important skill of the decades to come. And second to that, we'll be finding people to lean on and be inspired through it. On an individual basis, what are the ways or the tools you found for dealing with that constant rapid change? I don't think it's, although you're very good about staying on top of, you know, the latest apps and trends and content or whatever. It's like drinking from a fire hose sometimes, and that's also not realistic for everyone. They have to kind of parse and curate the things to pay attention to. What are those tools or those things you can use to navigate this rapidly changing future?
Oh man, I think it's really, really hard. I think the the main root thing here is, how do you maintain an openness? Maybe kind of as the purest distillation of it, which is to say, I don't know, I'm 29. I'm like no longer a kid. I'm not old. And I find myself for the first time in my life in the last year or two or a few years, like some things I'm like, these kids, they're crazy. Like one version of this I love, it's sort of trivial, but Jack Appleby on Twitter, he tweeted this thing a few months ago or maybe last year or whatever. He's talking to his parents about Instagram, and they like use Instagram a ton and they don't post. And he's like, guys, like why don't you ever post on Instagram? And they're like, I don't know, we just like to look. And he's like, it doesn't make any sense to me. And then he was reflecting like the next day or whatever, and he realized that that was the exact way he related to TikTok.
Right.
Whereas most people under the age of 25 or whatever probably posted TikTok videos. For what it's worth, yours truly has as well. But much more high energy cost. And I think it's easy to look at kind of the constant ground moving underneath you. The last 12 months of being bombarded by tweets and threads about how like you're falling behind because you're not using ChatGPT in this way. And there's some like cynicism there and ridiculousness, but one response there can just be like, I'm not going to bother. And inherently you can't possibly be on the cutting edge of everything. And by the way, this doesn't just apply in technology meetings. This is how people relate to music. At some point, it seems, the data seems to show that most people basically stop listening to new music, and they kind of like listen to the music they were into when they were, I don't know, 15 to 30 for the rest of their lives. The people I admire, by the way, most in that context are the ones who are continuously being open. I have this great, great memory of Elton John coming to USC, and he was there performing. It was cool. But the most memorable part of it was he was like just so excited to talk about like these up and coming artists that he was excited about. He spoke about Lorde. He's like, this girl, she's 17 or 18 or whatever, and she sings about getting on an airplane for the first time. Like, how amazing is that? And this guy's, I don't know, 70 or something at the time. He has no reason to need to care about anyone else. He could totally rest on his laurels, and yet he is like being renewed by the new energy. And so those two examples are not obviously the deepest ones. But I think fostering some ability to say, yeah, like I'm not going to be as in it and is like deeply native to ChatGPT is 16-year-olds coming up with it now, or to making videos and or whatever these things might be. But having some amount of like, I'm going to go at my own pace, but I'm going to keep an open mind, I think is probably upstream of most of the implications of this question. And there are different ways that we're going to have to relate to it. I think one of the things that I've been thinking about a little bit is like Stefan Engo, he runs this this app called Obsidian, this note-taking app. And he had a tweet recently where he talked about sort of like, don't delegate understanding or don't outsource understanding. And his claim was sort of like, we are increasingly moving towards a world where we just sort of like take everybody. We have all of these experts and we take other people. We're building on the shoulders of giants, which is an amazing tool. But also if you delegate all of your understanding, you are sort of, you have no depth at all. And I've been thinking about that, particularly in the context of a world where now maybe the dominant frame for influential people are these people we've outsourced, maybe not understanding, but certainly like curation to. You can imagine Joe Rogan is this like point of view that is like going to all of these different places and sort of asking questions and learning for you. And that's not to trivialize that. I think there's something very valuable about there, about that frame that podcast hosts, like things like this are. But there's got to be a balance between that and, my politics are what this guy's politics are because I trust them on all these other things, and being able to say like, I'm going to spend the day digging into what the latest thing with ChatGPT is or whatever. But again, I think it ultimately comes back to like, do I have an openness? Am I willing to let, and sometimes even like some cases, like push my curiosity uphill, even if it isn't easy, or I feel like I'm getting outdated or the ground's moving underneath me. How do you teach that? I think I could talk for a lot longer on probably, and as could you, but I think that's probably where you start.
Well, go for it. I'd love to hear how you go about teaching that.
Yeah. Maybe there's the question of like, how do you sort of teach from a first principle standpoint, like systemically in schools and things like that. I think that's something that I'm far less equipped, although I might have some ideas on. I think my hope would be that at least people who are in positions like I described, the Joe Rogan archetype, let's say, which I think is in some sense representative, in some sense like wild oversimplification, or I don't want to, there's people have different connotations for him specifically, but people like that. My hope would be that there is a move towards more of that type of content or format or influence that asks the consumer to lean in. And I think there's different ways that this might be manifest, but hopefully the internet is a deeply participatory medium. And I think that learning doesn't need to be the lecturer and the lecturee. I think there are different frames of this. I like the way that this is like a simple thing, but I like the way that David Senra, who runs the Founders Podcast, like he talks about you and I, like there's a conversation and a togetherness in that. But I think also like we probably just need more people with influence like that who are asking of their viewers or acknowledging to their viewers that like there is space here to learn together, and we need to, like, again, maybe this is just purely idealistic, but I do think that language matters. And maybe the other thing that I would challenge is just like how many people have even like made that frame object. Meaning, am I realizing that I'm outsourcing most of my worldviews to Joe Rogan or to whoever? Especially as we consume more and more and more, there's infinite content. We have these curators. Like, a curator should be a tool, a partner, a launching off point, and not like the entirety of how we digest. Perhaps that answer is not. I worry that maybe that answer is like a little downstream of like really teaching, like structurally. And I think that probably has to happen on a societal level by going further into education and like people earlier. Like, I suspect if you learn this type of frame early in your life, it is something that continues, and it's harder to learn as an adult. But maybe that's a start. And again, I think that we are just going to keep having these large curator point of view people. One frame of it is like generals and armies who sort of like decide for many, many people like how they learn, what they pay attention to, and that like that's a little bit scary. And I think we should probably always be like a little bit more, and we could probably, again, use more people who are sort of like acknowledge this and use it as part of like how they do what they do.
Is there selection bias for those types of curators that you think are developing the correct, quote unquote, correct relationship with their audience? So for example, not to shit on, you know, some reality TV show, Real Housewives or something, they are playing a similar function, establishing like a worldview for their viewers, but not doing it in this participatory way. Whereas, to continue with the example of Senra, he's encouraging that. Are those types of people just downstream of the personalities that kind of get attracted to that thing? And if so, I think it starts to bleed into what you were talking about, where we just have to teach it at a younger age and in a more systemic way. But I think, not to be incredibly pessimistic, ultimately it boils down to most people prefer comfort, mitigating uncertainty, don't like ambiguity. And so either you have to make it compulsory, which has a negative connotation or like negative reaction to it. Or you just let things kind of continue as they have been, which is people will self-select for that kind of environment or those kinds of curators. Is that a very negative outlook on this?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think hearing you say that and even just reflecting on my previous answer, like the Darwinian sort of seeming trend would be that the people who are most successful in this new world, I think that probably the easiest answer here would be Trump, are not playing the meta that way.
Right.
They are They are instead going quite literally the other direction and leaning into, as you just said, this, on some level, like human desire to like be like the security that comes from like having like a glorious leader who will like tell you what is and what to believe. Or at the very, maybe it's not so explicit. I don't think people are like relate to it that way, but I do think there is something sort of primal there that is sort of like, it's reflexive. Like it's reinforcing when Trump reinforces the things that I feel or want to believe, like I trust him more, and it goes both right. ways. I think there's plenty of reason to be pessimistic. And perhaps the answer then is not to naively hope for better influencers, for lack of a better articulation of what that is. And we need alternative modes. I think that there are different ways that the internet might still enable people to be moved, like have more agency even within their beliefs. I think, and that can go both ways too, by the way. I think like QAnon is probably like the best negative example of this. But there might be positive examples of this. I think there's probably learnings from religion here too, which is to say, like, are there belief systems or containers for belief that allow people to like maybe get on an escalator and have some amount of agency, but also be like ushered forward, that at least forces them to confront and have to sit for themselves or with the people there around them to understand these like parse through these hard questions rather than purely delegating them to a political party, to our belief system or whatever. There's balance there, certainly. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we see the largest like belief systems, whether they be religions or political parties or things like Bitcoin or whatever, often trend towards like pretty radical tribalism and not a lot of like diversity of belief. And instead if I am, there's probably some good research in here. Maybe it's even conflicting, but my suspicion is if you looked at the average Republican or Democrat today, there is like far more, and I think I've seen some data on this, there is like far more consistency of like, I believe all of the things Republicans believe rather than some kind of like Republicans are the best amalgamation of like all of the beliefs I've sat with. Again, this stuff is really, really hard to do. Like, how do I actually feel about the intricacies of whatever, gun control or what? Pick right. your sticky topic. Especially, I'm rambling here. I suspect that the answers for how we, maybe you and I or our friends or the person listening solves this in their own life, probably varies pretty dramatically with like, how do you solve it at a societal scale? And maybe I've spent too much time trying to like pontificate on what that looks like. Maybe the last thing I would say is, at the very least for the first half of that, meaning you and I and our friends, like probably challenging and pushing ourselves to spend a little bit more time in the messiness. It's easy to spend time on topics that are easier and fun. And for like one example of this might just be, it's tragic and telling that like the taboo of speaking about politics with your family of all people exists. Like of all of the people you should be able theoretically, and I promise I'm not trying to be preachy here, like, but of all of the people we should theoretically have the intimacy to like wade through the muck here. And yet it's like, it's literally the opposite. It's like, oh, never talk about that with the people you're closest with. Like, right. And maybe that more applying to extended family. I don't know. We should probably be a little bit more willing to, talk through these hard things and the change and all of these things that are coming and like being able to be comfortable in disagreement, even with the people we love too, and like work through those things, is probably a start. Solving it at a societal scale, I've clearly talked myself in circles and don't have a good answer for it. But
yeah, I don't have a good answer either. I think the trouble lies in the fact that getting to the root of beliefs is more than a full time job. And so when people are like, think about the infinite depth in every single belief you have. And the effort and willpower and like pushing against inertia would take to get to the very bottom of that thing and be able to suss out like, Do I actually buy this? Do I buy all the constituent pieces here that together make up this belief? Think about the myriad of ways in your life that that exists. We just don't have time for that. So of course you have to outsource some amount of your thinking. And yet I think the people who think for themselves and don't outsource it, I bet there's some correlation between that and success by whatever metric, you want to think about. And I think
and they probably hang out together as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's further reinforcement there. And we're going to continue to see, I think, a divide between those who are, as I mentioned earlier, comfortable, not interested in uncertainty, want resolution, even if it's outsourced, and those who are willing to be uncomfortable and agentic and seek out the answers and build things. And unfortunately, I think that's just a divide in humanity that's like unavoidable. Yet, I think on the margins, you can improve it. So can we raise somebody's ambitions or desire to do that by 10 or 20%? And maybe that gets amplified the younger and younger you go. But at the end of the day, I think there are just, whether it's innate or like early childhood environments that aren't kind of reproducible or we don't really understand what's going on there, you're going to have this divide.
Yeah,
I certainly think this, by the way, I think is one of the reasons that this sort of like interplay between sociology and technology and the internet is so important. Like, undeniably, the information revolution has changed the way that people relate to this stuff, I think. I think it's probably undeniable. And in a world, you can't possibly like separate all this stuff. But in a world without Facebook, people probably would be delegating belief, at least in a different way. And so maybe the answer is that it's not like it's replacement rather than something entirely new. And we've delegated. We went from delegating understanding to the guy on the TV to whatever your favorite podcast host or Alex Jones or whatever. That said, in the other point that you hinted at that I think really does matter is that I don't think agency, at least in its purest form, which is a slightly different thing than what we're talking about, but I think it's very related, is I don't think it's like a binary. I do not think that there are like agentic people who are curious and want to understand and be open, and then there are people who just like are looking to download information. I think it is undeniably a spectrum, and I think people can be moved up to that spectrum. And I think as more of the world sort of like learns from participatory interaction, is like gamification, like all of these ways, there are ways that that can be sort of shifting people towards being cogs, and there are ways that that can prompt people and cause them to discover and learn from, like. And so I think there really is a lot of design space there, both for people's individual lives and fulfillment, as well as for how they approach learning or ideologies or curiosity or the fact that the world is changing. And I think that stuff's really actually worth delving in.
On the note of these kind of curators or mouthpieces that we outsource our thinking to, we've seen an insane rise in kind of parasocial relationships over the last, you could go back to television or even the radio to say that those are early examples of this or analogs. But especially in recent history, people are starting to treat kind of these parasocial relationships like they would almost their real friendships. And so I've been thinking a lot about, and actually a couple episodes ago, I had Emmett Shear on, the co-founder and CEO of former CEO of Twitch. We talked about this a bit. What is your take on the healthy or unhealthiness of parasocial relationships? And I think there's a spectrum here. But do you think it is a net good thing for humanity? And do you think we're trending in the right direction in terms of how we use those parasocial relationships?
Yeah. I was talking about this with some friends recently. I think it's a can of worms for sure. Because it opens up a lot of sort of like, if you really get to some of the deep questions here, like I think it gets into sort of like some ethical and moral questions even potentially. And I think it's also worth acknowledging that AI is just going to just radically accelerate how we have to think about these types of questions. I think it's worth noting that having somebody who you don't know, who you pay a lot of attention to, isn't inherently parasocial, I don't think. Or at least it's a spectrum. Like, I think the news broadcaster or whatever, or even a traditional celebrity, is very, very different from like a Twitch streamer or some of the kind of extreme ends of modern parasocial relationships. You think about the extremes of whatever, Twitch or Ice Cream So Good Girl or whatever. And I think it probably depends a ton on the tone and the person and all this stuff. On one hand, we have like a, I mentioned earlier, we have like a meeting crisis. I think people are deeply lonely. Like, this is not something that's going to go away. And it would be basically impossible to fundamentally solve like the loneliness problem, with, like pure natural, like intimate human relationships. I think at least that's like very, very, very far in the post abundant, like, or post scarcity world. And I don't know how to solve that. On the other hand, I really do worry about it. And I think that it sort of gets to the thing we were talking about earlier with the we have these curators for points of view and like how are they going to be good stewards of this attention? The problem is I think that the game is currently structured in a way that incentivizes sort of like being maximally exploitive here. And I think that people are going to continue to do that. I think that AI, whatever, whether it's friends or girlfriends or pets or whatever, there will be great versions of it. And then there will be like probably really, really problematic versions of it for it. Like, but again, I think this delves down into like at the end of the day for a person who has no one else, is it better for them to have the perception of intimacy or to be truly alone? I think like, when push comes to shove, I would probably say it's better. I don't know that I have a good or useful answer for solving this at a wide level. And I think people like Emmett are certainly better to ask. I would challenge certainly the platforms that enable this type of stuff to think really, really hard about the rules of the games and what they incentivize. I think there's a reason, and this might be my bias showing, but I think there's a reason that probably most podcast parasocial relationships are probably healthier on the margin than live streaming for a handful of reasons. I think the primary one being that the inherent like money-based dynamic participatory piece creates some like potentially challenging incentives. The thing I would just really say though is like I think it's really worth being mindful, going back to the earlier point of like for you and me, like what are the ways that like I am allowing this to seep into my life and is it healthy? Which is, again, maybe doesn't matter in the grand scheme, but I think it's probably worth everybody thinking a little bit more about. And there, I think it applies to creators too. And there's different creators who lean really hard into this. There's this like famous clip from Ludwig on Twitch where he talks about like, you and I are not friends to his viewer. And like, I'm really glad to be entertaining you. And like, that's it. We are not friends. I don't know. Like, again, everyone's going to have their different style there. And clearly, leaning into the intimacy and the parasocial piece has worked really well for lots of people. And I'm not going to sit here and say that that is like wrong, because I think it is like way, way, way more prey than that. So, yeah.
I'm not sure I'd call it right or wrong either. Although, I don't know. I might go as far as to say the extreme versions of it are wrong, or at least will have radically negative and order effects on humanity. Like the one I've been thinking about, and I mentioned this on my episode with Ava Huang. I think she goes by like Book Bear or Noam Pomsky, which is a great handle. I said like envisioning a future where we have AI powered like kind of sex bots or girlfriend boyfriend bots. Eventually with a future of hardware and haptics, where like you're getting like 85 to 90% as close as like a real human interaction. And yet with like 1% of the effort, you don't have to ever be denied or embarrassed. Like you would be out at a bar trying to ask somebody out. It's always in the comfort of your own home. You can tweak the characteristics to your liking. I think there is a lot of value in people being, going to our other point, like historically you've had to be pushed out of your comfort zone a little bit. It's just, that's the only way you would meet people and make friends. And once we remove that and we make the barrier to replacement or 90% replacement that low, I just can't see that doing anything but exacerbating loneliness. And so I worry about that. And yet I recognize, like, nobody listens to this podcast, but my mom maybe. Like, there's maybe, I am doing a medium or an art that is also still parasocial. And so I don't know how to reconcile the two, but I have concerns about it. And yet I think, to a point you made, there are individual kind of tactics or like philosophies you can apply to this to help get the best out of it. Because I think there is value. Like when I'm working out, I'm not going to be on the phone with a friend. It's not replacement time. Instead, I'm listening to my favorite podcast. So maybe it's just picking your moments and being really thoughtful about your usage. But yeah, I do have fears about it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I the root of this is like, we are like, biologically, we are not prepared for what this
for
is.
Any
like
of this.
The classic image of the kids sitting in front of the poster of the people talking. It's like, this is what podcasts right. are like. Our brains like can't fully distinguish that. I think there's plenty of good that's come from like the ways that the internet and the information revolution have like changed the way we get to, even just like the way people learn. There are YouTube and podcasts alone, like just radically transformative positively. And I think that there's plenty of room for optimism for how this could be good. I know that's certainly, at least in some ways, how Ava feels, like there is room for a positive version of this outcome. I think the other thing that we just need to acknowledge is like, people 20 years from now or 10 years from now might not care. Like, they are going to have a different way they relate to this than you and I. I think along with reiterating that I just don't know and I don't have the mm-hmm. answers here, I think what this type of questioning highlights, though, is maybe what I tried to articulate earlier, which is we are marching towards an inevitable technical future of all of these outcomes. Like, if they can, they will. Like, greed will motivate technical outcomes, maybe more than anything else. And many of the implications here are not technology problems. They are sort of how we as a human race like move forward and stay sane and be healthy or be fulfilled or work with each other and not turn against each other. This is such a small version of it. But in many ways, I think is expressive of like the way things that are going to have to go. And we're going to have to get better at being able to think about and parse out how we relate to these things, how our friends do. And eventually at some point, do we need to have regulation about the stuff? At the very least, for the platform builders, how do they think about it? And obviously they certainly are, and they've thought about it a lot more than people like I have. But mm-hmm. This stuff is technology is not this like separate walled off thing from culture and society. No. Like it is seeping into all of the crevices.
Yeah, messy and highly unpredictable. On the note of connections and friendships, I've sensed through your writing, as well as I listened to your episode of Real Friends with my friend Jake the other day, where you guys talked about your four favorite movies. There was a theme running through all of them that was about human connection, friendship, relationships. So I know that you value that highly. How are you thinking about how to best leverage the internet to develop relationships that aren't just only on the internet, that are deeper? We can treat this as a two-part question here. What do we need to do better in the physical world, to our earlier point, such that we aren't relying wholly or exclusively on those kind of internet relationships as a replacement? Yeah. Like, how do we bridge the two or marry them?
Great question. I have an answer for the second part. I the first part, I think, is like, I benefited from a fairly kind of like special time, I guess, or unique time, mainly on Twitter, where like I met just like a whole bunch of people that have like really deeply impacted me or become close friends or introduced me to other close friends or whatever through Twitter, I'm kind of hanging out there from, like, I don't know, 2012 to 2018, maybe a little longer. And I think that was, like, in many ways, it was this sort of weird place where people were deeply curious, and, like, you get to meet people based on what they're interested in rather than who they are. And that led to, like, a ton of specialness for me. And I don't think that Twitter is that place anymore. At least I don't experience that way. That's not to say it couldn't be. But I'm definitely confident the internet will continue to allow that in some form, whether it's, I don't know where it's happening. Maybe it's in Discord servers or whatever, or people, maybe it is happening on Twitter or X, excuse me, and I'm just cynical. I always think the internet will be amazing at that. And I think if you're, like, actually curious and you are willing to, like, go a little past a little bit of friction, you can form amazing relationships. Most people are reachable. And if you go, like, a little above and beyond, or you're just the first person to say hi, you could probably reach them, and there's lots of opportunity there. So still very long, the internet being a great place for connection. On the second question, which is, what does the physical world need to do? I think I don't know if this is a controversial view. Maybe it's not an intuitive view to some people, and it's certainly been learned for me, but I think relationships are basically, like, fundamentally maybe even somewhat constrained by proximity. Like, I think proximity is actually pretty much underrated in almost all contexts for relationships. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is to say, there are people who you might see who you've done a lot of work with, and you've had a relationship for a long time. Maybe your best friend from high school, and you could see that person once a year, and you can have a ton of depth and intimacy and catch up and have all of this this great kind of relational energy. But my argument would be that without some kind of proximity, that relationship is going to be quite different than one that has proximity, regardless of how much depth existed before, or even depth can happen in the moment. Meaning, I think that relationships are actually a mix of depth and proximity, not just one or the other. And obviously, proximity alone doesn't get you anywhere. But this is the reason that I think that some digital spaces, whether they be video games or Twitter, as I described it, or whatever it might be, as well as some physical spaces like very dense cities or college, the reason they produce so many relationships is that it turns out getting to know someone and really becoming comfortable with them or going deep with them or whatever isn't just a measure of, like, who you are and how much you connect. Part of it is just, like, the collision. And I find that, like, many of my closest relationships, we can go really, really deep, and we often do. But also the sort of current of a relationship is the idle time, is the doing groceries together, is hanging out, is playing video games, whatever those might be. And I think that oftentimes people can underrate that. So when it comes to the physical world, obviously there's lots of people who said all kinds of things about the ways that we can evolve cities. There's been also kind of plenty of conversation these days about, like, third spaces and how you design for that. I think that we can do a lot more. And I do think the city work is probably, like, the most fundamental piece of this. I'm moving to New York imminently, despite loving Los Angeles, in part because I'm seeking more proximity. And there are people who are great at doing this in the micro scale, whether it be bringing people together and things like that. The point I would make is that I think I would just encourage people to think about this more in the context of the relationships they care about, and try to be somewhat intentional about designing areas for proximity to happen, rather than it being an uphill, like, high activation energy every time. And that can be literally something as simple as, like, we have an active group text that is, like, mainly trivial stuff and fun and, like, not about depth. I have two of my best friends. I'm moving to New York, and this will be the first time we've all lived in the same city. I met them on Twitter. We became friends over the years, and we've certainly had moments of depth where we go on trips together and things like that. But we also had this, like, little group text that is 90% random links and fun things we're talking about. There's no expectation of it being deep. But that in many ways has been the current of, like, why I am so close to them, and probably closer to them than I am to most people I live or have lived right around. And I think it speaks to this, like, the idle little time. There's a reason that people meet people they care about in work and in school and in church and these types of places where there can be collision. Again, I don't want to talk the endless City third place thing, because I think there's all kinds of interesting stuff happening there. But I think on an individual level, getting better at like considering that and valuing it, maybe even as much as the deep stuff, might help people.
That reminds me of one of my favorite quotes about relationships from this guy. I think you pronounce his name Zat Rana. He's since like deactivated his Twitter. I've been trying to find him. I want to bring him on. Mm. He has this great quote that's something to the effect of, there's three ways we talk with other people: through deep talk, banter, and small talk. You can only go so deep with people so many times. Small talk gets annoying. It's that banter that really keeps a relationship alive and is kind of fills that in between time like you're talking about.
I love that.
So I thought there was some interesting overlap there. Having worked in VC, you're very familiar with kind of the financial mechanisms and infrastructure for funding projects, but those are exclusively kind of projects with outsized financial return, startups. I think there is space for, except in rare cases, I would say. I think there is still a need for enabling and incentivizing the creation of more art. The kind of canonical example is the Medici Firenze period of time. What do you think we can do to better kind of provoke or enable and incentivize the creation of more art? And maybe that's not financial. Maybe there's something else, some other kind of support. But how do we get more art into the world?
Man, there's people who would know way more about this than me. My two hunches would be, one, I think that this is one of the things I got really excited about in crypto, is like, I think crypto and NFTs, like more than anything, are about patronage and like provenance, in at least in the artistic and creative sense. And so there's like a inherently, like, that's not, I don't think it's in contradiction with the hyper-financialized piece of things, but I don't think it's exactly the same thing. I think that the internet still can be a lot better than it is for allowing like the patronage of art, like really in a way that, like, again, patron fandom, like these ideas are, they maybe overlap. But I think that like, that is probably all art really needs to continue to be supported and financed. Like, I think patronage is like how art has always been financed pretty much. And like, it's probably, and now we have like, that's been made kind of democratized and like widely accessible to everyone in the world. And turns out like there's somebody who, if you can make something that resonates with somebody, like there's probably a path there. It's a thousand vans or whatever. That's one piece of it. That's the financial piece. But as you alluded to, I think the more important part is like, is not probably that. It's hard to say like how many artists should exist in the world. Like, should everyone be an artist? And like, there's an audience one, whatever. I'm not sure. I'm more interested in the second thing though, which is like, how do you prompt more people into channeling their being into something that is art like? And that can be very tactical and specific and have a ton of form or much more loose. It probably depends on like how you define art, of which there are a million frames. Mm-hmm. Maybe a couple I like would be, Shia LaBeouf says anything that moves you is art. I don't know if he was being serious, but I always loved that. And then he was asked, are memes art? And he says anything that moves you is art. And then I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, is art anything more than sort of transmuting the senses into shareable form? If art is like, or creativity is being able to see, all you really have to do is be able to put it in something, like at least in the, like, this is what art means to humanity. All long-winded way of saying that I suspect there could be a lot more artists in the world, or more of us could be creative and do art-like things in different frames. And for the people who don't feel like they are artistic or creative, it is probable that they haven't found the right form for that, or they haven't been nudged or prompted to it. And that applies across the stack, from like, did you get to experience art early on in education, to like, can we create new tools? Like, it turns out the iPhone made a lot more photographers than existed before, in the same way that might AI assisted programming change the way people relate to software? Can software be art? Like, the amount of software engineers or the amount of people who create software in the world is certainly going to 10 to 100x with AI. Mm-hmm. Like, what does that mean? I'm really interested in that. I think the money stuff kind of gets solved over time. At the very least, I think crypto and things like it will enable more. There'll be more people who make a theoretically livable wage by creating things that people love because of the like democratized patronage stuff.
Is AI art, AI generated art, less than for some reason? Is it can it be as human or beautiful as traditional art, or is it really no different than the use of technology in the past to create art, whether that's Photoshop or a camera?
I think this goes back to some of the like generational stuff we've talked about, which is to say, I suspect most people today feel that there's a clear difference and that at some point in the future, people won't. And I think art is what people believe about it. So I don't know if there's another way to answer it. Other people might disagree. I think the interplay between creativity and tools and mediums is really, really unbelievably fun and fascinating to think about. And I think that people generally underrate how much the medium is the message. Even the ways that like the internet in so many ways is not like a medium. It's like a million new mediums for which us to for like we can experience it. And the way that game shapes the player there, like there's so much. If you told me like there's no way that there will be some totally transformative new form of art someday that is created with AI or in some form that like deeply moves people, I would be totally shocked. Like, I think that will happen. Even if there is a lot of like weird stuff to get through and by the way, there might be people who will never ever be able to feel something deeply about AI art or whatever because of a story in their head. And that's just going to be the case for them. But I think it will happen.
As of today, we'll hold out and wait and see what that kind of future new art form looks like. In your opinion, what's the highest art form and why? And I'll throw out a few of the options here. And you've worked in a couple of these industries. Music, film, video games, novels, painting. There's a long list here, but
oh my gosh, it's an impossible question. I think that is the wrong way to think about art, would be my answer. My favorite probably my favorite is probably film. I really love some novels too. And what I think I love about that is it's just such a beautiful articulation of like constraints enabling all kinds of incredible creativity. And in many ways, movies for at least like 100 years there were sort of like the peak of like pop art in some way. Like it was sort of like maximally commercial with this like very specific form factor that also allowed for such like radically expressive, beautiful feeling in art and story. And like there was this weird, like just everything kind of collided in a way that allowed it to be this kind of really unbelievable thing. And I think that peak is probably over. But what I love about it is it's just like, I think there is very little, I don't think there's another medium that like, I have more things that sit with me than the tightness of like, here's whatever, 90 to 180 minutes of like, I'm going to tell you something and I'm going to like try to express the magic of life in this form for you, like here right now. And there's no expectation past that. Like, but anyway, to answer your original question, like there's no way that maybe someday we'll be able to answer that. And it will be something that is either so distilled and kind of pure or so personal or something like, I suspect that over time, as art becomes more and more interactive or participatory, or maybe it's something collective, and there's something kind of like deeply, universally, collectively human that allows us to transcend. But yeah, anyway, for me, I think it's movies.
I had favorite,
not the best.
Yeah, it's ultimately a preference. I had Eric Wahlberg on, who's starting this or has started this company called Prophetic AI that's attempting to stimulate lucid dreaming states.
Wow.
And so I was thinking about a future where, I mean, to use Shia's description, if it's something that moves you and it has a certain level of kind of fidelity or comparison to real life, to lived life, then like the ability to dream of anything and have control over those dreams could someday be the highest art form. There's a question of maybe how do you capture that and share it with others. I'm not sure that's a prerequisite to art, but it can be personal and individual.
I would also say, like, even though I kind of had in my description earlier, like, I'm not confident that art has to be shareable. There's an articulation of this from a guy named Josh Waitzkin, who wrote this book like The Art of Learning and done a bunch of different things. And he sort of talks about learning as unobstructed self-expression. And within that, he talks about, like, I mean, his book's called The Art of Learning, but like he's currently a foil surfer and is like the main thing he does. I asked him, like, why, what are you training for? Like, you used to do jujitsu and chess and like all these things. And he's like, I'm training for virtuosity. And I he uses the word art to describe the surfing, like the art. That doesn't really imply any kind of like sharing, I don't think, or like even it being interrelational. Like, so I'm not sure. I think that, like, as technology continues to change, the ways that we can relate to things as well as the ways that we can share things, I suspect like the boundaries of this will continue to just get wider and wider and kind of like, who knows? It's cool to think about. Dream telling is a fun form someday.
Right. We'll ask the same question in closing to all guests, which is, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
Maybe where and how I spend my time in my days do I feel the most alive?
Excellent. Jackson, thank you so much. We went way over. Really appreciate your time.
This is fun.
And we'll definitely be doing this again at some point.
Cool.
Thank you, sir.
This is fun. See you soon.